Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Today is Tuesday, and this week on the Radio Cafe, we are running the opera series that we aired in June. Today's show corresponds to tonight's opera at the Santa Fe Opera, and this Friday we'll be talking about the Santa Fe Opera's Apprentice Singers Program. I'd like to introduce Desiree Mays. She's the author of Opera Unveiled, the book now in its 11th year that describes the five operas of the Santa Fe Opera season. Desiree lectures nightly at the Preview Buffet of the Santa Fe Opera. She's an international opera lecturer and spends much of the winter season lecturing at the Metropolitan Opera in New York. And she's tour director of Act One Tours, which takes people all over the world to see opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
There are some things that we haven't talked about, like there are some opportunities for young people to attend the opera.
Yes, that's right. There's a series called Youth Nights, where the opera company has made it possible for families to come to the opera because you don't often see kids at the opera, and yeah, opera's expensive. So in this case, these are really rock-bottom prices, and you'd have to call the opera to get those prices. But if you bring a couple of kids or acquire a couple of kids, you can come to what are, in effect, the final dress rehearsals of three productions this season. The first is on the 29th of June, and that'll be La Traviata. That'll be quite something to see Natalie Dessay singing this role, and she really rises to the occasion when there are kids in the audience. She has two of her own who are young, and it's very. I have talked to singers who believe that this final dress rehearsal is maybe the most important of all because they're reaching new audience, and it's so exciting to see these families and kids all wrapped up in blankets in the audience. The Pueblo families come with large numbers all wrapped in those wonderful blankets, and the kids may be asleep through part of it, but they're there, and it's a tradition, and I think it's great that the opera makes this available to families. So there are three evenings this can happen, and they all start at 9 o'clock. So that, for young kids, is exciting in and of itself. It starts at 9. They'll be there late. And the first one is, as I said, June 29th for La Traviata, and then the following night on June 30th for the Elixir of Love, and on the 14th of July, they can go to the final dress rehearsal of Don Giovanni. So they should call the opera company at 800-280-4654 or go online, santafeopera.org, and you'll find all about how to take your family to the opera. And this
dress rehearsal, it's really the real thing. I mean, it's
typically,
you know,
yes.
There are occasionally, I mean, I've been to a lot of those with you,
right,
Desiree,
right. Mm-hmm.
And occasionally the director will stop the actions and
occasionally,
or something will fall, you know.
That's right.
But
or
it
stick.
Really is,
yeah.
And also occasionally, but not always, one of the singers will not be singing in full voice.
Yes, because they need to save their voice for the opening night, which
right.
usually follows. But typically, it's a straight run through, and it's exciting to see when it does stop to see how the whole thing works. It's amazing. The only thing that the production people ask of audiences is that you are completely quiet when there is a pause, and even at the intermissions, they'll tell you when it's time to get up and move around because they give notes and all sorts of things go on. But it gives you a little sort of insight as to how the thing is put together, though typically, as you say, it is a straight run through. It should be. It's the final time they do it
exactly.
Before the opening night.
So we're talking today about La Traviata.
We are.
Giuseppe Verdi.
Yes, I love Verdi. Verdi is one of the all-time great composers who tells magnificent stories. And this piece comes from what they call the middle period of his career, where he presented three super hits, Rigoletto, Il Trovatore, and La Traviata. La Traviata was a departure for Verdi because he writes of a social situation in his own time. He writes about courtesans. Now, courtesans are a very special breed of lady.
Yeah, explain that, because it's not – have an equivalent today? I don't think so.
I don't know. They're probably out there. You may not call
maybe
them
in Washington,
courtesans. Yes, very glamorous women who are mistresses, or even not even more than mistresses. There's a fine line. These women are not prostitutes. They decide who they are going to have as their lovers, and they sort of set the terms. And typically that means a house, a horse, and carriage in those days, fantastic jewels and seats at all the operas. They love to go to the opera and the theater. That actually makes sense, I suppose. those. So these were women who came at a very interesting time in history. In Paris in the Second Empire is a typically Parisian thing. I mean, it gave Paris its title Gay Paris because of the licentiousness and, you know, what went on, where men would have courtesans. They would be married and have children in their stately homes, but they would have courtesans to play. And they would move from one to the other. These were sort of short-term affairs, typically, when the man either got bored of his lady lover or ran out of money. Now, these were the aristocracy right up to the crowned heads. I mean, the kings of Europe would have mistresses, as we know through history.
How did the wives feel about this?
They didn't have a say. I mean, in this situation, the wife had to sort of deal with it. Hers was probably an arranged marriage. She had the protection and safety of her class. She was an aristocrat.
She didn't get a boy courtesan.
No, it did not work that way. You see, men behaved this way. This was the terrible double standard that I think Verdi wanted to point up, that men could do exactly as they wanted, but women could not. On the women's side, if you belong to the aristocracy, fine. If you didn't, you might be a servant in a big household. That would give you a job. But if you were on your own and you were not married, there was a very real risk of starvation and death. So this opera starts with a true life story, a young woman from Normandy called Alphonsine Plessis. She had a gentle mother, apparently, who died, and a terrible father, very cruel and abusive, and sort of farmed her out to the local farmers and then sold her to gypsies. There's all sorts of stories. Finally, she arrives in Paris. She's 15 years of age and destitute. So she becomes a grisette, a seamstress, a laundress. Now, this character is known from La Bohème.
Right, Mimi. Who's so cold.
That's right.
in her little attic,
sewing flowers on rich ladies' hats. So Alphonsine decides this is not the life for her. She wants more than this. She wants to live a life of luxury. She wants to live. So she's taken up by a number of men in quick succession. She rapidly learns how to behave like a lady. And she has a number of lovers. All sorts of incredible people were her lovers. There was an older man who fell in love with her because she resembled his daughter who had died. He set her up in a house, and the condition was that she'd give up the rest of her lifestyle, but she couldn't do it. So that ended. There was another man who married her, actually, the Comte de Perigord, who married her in the London Registry Office when she was 22 years of age. So she did become a Comtesse. But that marriage fell apart. It's not clear what happened. There was no relationship. He left her, and she returned to Paris and her wild life. Franz Liszt was one of her lovers and could never get her out of his system, he said. Afterwards, there was something enigmatic about this beautiful young woman. But she had consumption, tuberculosis, which was the curse of women at that time, and she died at 23 years of age. At her death, her husband appeared after she was dead and provided a burial site for her in Montmartre Cemetery. So you can visit that cemetery. And, you know, camellias were placed on her tomb every week for years after she lived. The Lady of the Camellias, she was known as. And nobody knew ever where these camellias came from.
So if a wealthy man married one of these women, did she then become accepted?
Not really. There was always the black mark. You know, she was never accepted into a high society. They could rub shoulders with the aristocracy when they rode their carriages in the Bois de Boulogne, or where they went to the races at Longchamp, or when they were in the opera. She would hold court in a box. She had her own box, and she would always have the camellias on the banquette in front of her. So it was an extraordinary time, and one that it was a short time of craziness during the time of Napoleon III that, of course, all had to come to an end, and did. But Verdi took this up, and for him at the time it must have been fairly personal, because he was having a relationship with a woman called Giuseppina Strapponi. Strapponi had been a wonderful singer. In fact, she sang in the first performance of Abigail in Nabucco, and they had stayed in touch over the years. But her voice had peaked, and she was no longer a great soprano, and she was a woman alone and had a series of protectors. These were relationships that she had. So when Verdi and Strapponi go to the theater to see this play, La Dame aux Camélias, it certainly rang a bell.
Right.
The play was by Alexandre Dumas, who had actually had an affair with Marie Duplessis, the real woman. It was a very short affair, 11 months. He was passionately in love with her. But it came to an end because he was a poor writer and he had no money, and she wanted to maintain this lifestyle. So the way he got over it was writing her story, La Dame aux Camélias, which made him, ironically, a superstar overnight. Everybody in Paris wanted to know what went on inside the courtesan's boudoir. All the women were dying to find out, and the
right.
men were trying to find out if they were in the book, this sort of situation. So that was what happened. Verdi and Strepponi saw the opera, and Verdi decided this would be his next opera. He really...
It was an opera or a play?
It was a play. Dumas was a play.
Right.
Yeah, Alexandre Dumas. This was the son of Alexandre Dumas-Père, who wrote The Count of Monte Cristo. This was his actually illegitimate son. So that was sort of the background of what happened.
So they see this play. Verdi says, "Oh boy, we got to do something here."
Yeah,
and writes La Traviata.
He went home and instantly contacted his librettist Piave and said, "We wanted to do this opera." He actually wrote to him and said, "This is a subject of our time. Others would not have done it because of the conventions, the epoch, and for a thousand other stupid scruples." He wanted it to be performed in modern dress, but the censor would not allow this. Now, everybody knew about the existence of courtesans, but they could not be shown on the stage. I mean, again, the double standard that you keep running into that Verdi couldn't be doing with. So they made the production in the time of Louis the XIV. Everyone was in long wigs, in scarlet and blue silks with white lace collars. I mean, totally out of context for the piece. But the opera did well, and as time went on, it was about 50 years later that it finally was moved to the 1850s, where it truly belonged. Shortly after this, a few years after this, Verdi and Strepponi were married, and they were one of the happy married couples of opera in history. So that story had a happy ending.
But in other words, before that, or even at the beginning of their relationship, which wasn't, I mean... people would, in his town, would reject her.
Yeah.
Even
totally.
When she went to church.
That's right. They totally reject. This is Catholic Italy, northern Italy. And because they were not married, they could not live together, and yet they were living together. And she was totally isolated by
Catholic
that community.
Catholic means universal and all-embracing.
It does.
Yes. Did once.
So it was tough in the beginning, and she suffered for this. But finally, they were married. And actually, everyone came to love Giuseppina. It had been for Verdi a tragedy in his early 20s. He married the daughter of his mentor in the village of Busetto, where they all lived, and they had two infant children. But in the space of 2 years, all three died.
Oh, heavens.
I mean, a young wife, he was passionate about her, and two children. And today you can visit there's a home that Verdi set up in Milano for old singers, for singers whose careers have ended. They can live there. And in the center courtyard of this, Verdi is buried. And on one side is Margherita and the two children, and on the other side is Giuseppina. She came into his life long. He was going to give it all up. He wasn't going to have anything else to do with opera when they died. But history showed differently. Thank goodness we have all these wonderful works.
So let's play some music and set up the story for us.
Yes, the prelude is unexpected. You expect a lively prelude, but he chose to take the story from the third act when Violetta is alone and dying. And this is the prelude. It sort of sets the mood for the whole piece, and you get a sense of what's to come. It's a very beautiful piece, the prelude to La Traviata.
Thank you.
That's the prelude to La Traviata. It's not called an overture anymore.
In this case, no, but yeah. It amounts to the same thing, I suppose. It's interesting in the Santa Fe production that you'll see, the director is the great Laurent Pelly, who is one of the great French directors of our time. And he has chosen not to use the traditional sets of the luxurious, sumptuous apartments in which Violetta lived, but a series of movable shapes, I suppose. And what he does with the opening in this prelude is very interesting. He sets the opening at a funeral. The people are burying Violetta at actually Marguerite from the Dumas story, because the Dumas story starts with her burial at her death and then looks back mm-hmm. into what happens. It actually starts with an exhumation, which is sort of grim in the book, but we won't have that here, but we will have the opening in the cemetery, and that's why they're doing it. That comes directly from the book. Anyway, once this ends, suddenly the whole thing lights up, literally. The chandeliers come on, and we're at a party at Violetta's fabulous apartments in the Rue Madeleine. And the Baron, who is her current protector, is mingling with the friends, and he notices a young man standing on the side a little bit shyly and awkwardly. He's come with a count who introduces him as Alfredo Germont from the country, and he's a bit tongue-tied, and the Baron's sort of mildly amused. He's introduced to Violetta, and she's sympathetic, but she doesn't pay much attention. And then someone suggests it's time to raise their glasses and propose a toast to Violetta, their wonderful hostess. And the Baron's sort of not bothered. He's a bit bored. I mean, he insults her in a way. He doesn't want to take the time. So he turns to Alfredo and says, "How about you doing it?" Which puts the kid on the spot. You know, he's from the country and here he is in this first night in Paris. But he's in love with Violetta. He has heard before that she had been ill, and he brought flowers to her every day. And anyway, he decides that he will be the one. So she brings him a glass of champagne and sort of challenges him with her eyes, hands him the glass, and he sings what is a brindisi, which is a drinking song. All the best operas have great drinking songs. And this is the one that comes right at the beginning of La Traviata Libiamo. The Violetta you will hear is Patricia Racette here, and Marcello Alvarez is the Alfredo.
Viviamo negli echi calici che la bellezza infiora e là fuggevo l'ora sine mia voluta. Viviamo e volti mi prendi che suscita l'amore, poiché quell'occhio al cuore onnipotente va. destine così.
Rousing finale to that drinking song.
Yes, indeed. And now that's Patricia Rosett.
Yes, this is actually from a Metropolitan Opera recording with Marcello Alvarez as her Alfredo. And you'll hear some of the audience noise in the background. That's that's from the Met. Patricia Rosett, of course, is going to be singing our Leslie in the letter. So it's
and
interesting to hear.
Tell our audience who's going to be singing La Traviata.
We have Natalie Desay. And this is going to be it's sort of a real coup, and the whole opera world is excited about it because Natalie Desay has not yet sung a complete Violetta. It's a role that sopranos wait for. You just can't rush in and do it, and you have to have tremendous stamina and extraordinary, that bel canto sound ease of the voice. And not all voices are going to be able to do it. It's very demanding. You can wreck your voice with this piece.
Really?
Yeah. It's something people wait for. Patricia Rosett now does an extraordinary job with it. And for Natalie, everybody's waiting to see how it will be. Natalie Desay, of course, is the French coloratura that has got now worldwide fame from the HD Met screenings for her extraordinary performance in La Fille du Régiment, The Daughter of the Regiment, where she's singing her heart out and doing all this incredible coloratura stuff while she's ironing the soldiers.
Right. Now, the HD Met screenings, for those who don't know, high definition instantaneous live. Mm-hmm. Transmission from the Metropolitan Opera in New York to all sorts of places, including the Lenzing.
Yes, there's something like 300 theaters worldwide who show this simultaneously as it goes out. And so you get it at funny times of the day.
Yeah.
And the Lenzing has it here in Santa Fe. It's the second year we've done it, and we'll be doing it into the future. There's another series coming up next year. And in Albuquerque, there's a theater too. So it's become extraordinarily popular. In my book, it's the next best thing to sitting in the house. Nothing beats sitting there for a live performance and being really a part of it. Even sitting in front of the screen, one's a little distant. Though it's interesting, the audiences in the cinema applaud just as if they were in a theater.
Yeah. And some people like it because, of course, there are so many cameras
that
you can see, you know, the sweat dripping off the brow of the hero in action or whatever it
is. You're up close and sometimes all too personal. Right
until
down
you get
there.
Tonsils. Through,
exactly.
Yeah.
They're doing a better job now, I think, of filming this. Before, I mean, at one point they seem to be filming everybody from the footlights up the characters. You sort of see the skirts and then the face would be up at the top. It wasn't working well. But
do they keep those or are they just, I mean, do they keep a record of them? Can you see them later?
Oh, yes. And the Met has those. You can tune into the Met and see them whenever you want. They now have a program that you can do that. And they eventually become DVDs and you'll get them that way.
Right.
They are quite wonderful. So she did La Fille du Régiment and she also did La Sonnambula, which is another sort of lighter role. But Natalie Desay is known for her dramatic roles as well. Her Lucia de Lammermoor is one of the greats. She's great at mad scenes. And next winter at the Metropolitan Opera, she'll be singing Ophelia in Hamlet. So there's an amazing range, this woman. She's got a very beautiful, very facile, extraordinary voice that once you hear, you don't easily forget. She loves being here. She's been to Santa Fe a number of times now. She sang Pamina in The Magic Flute, and she sang La Sonnambula. She comes here with her family. She has two young children, and she loves to be up at the pool when she's not singing with the kids with a book in hand. She's an avid reader. She said if she wasn't a singer, she'd be a bookkeeper in Paris.
She's also a little sylph. I mean, she's this
she's tiny.
Ethereal wisp of a person. You can't believe that all this music comes out of her.
No, it's amazing.
Her little body.
Yeah, but she also
and she moves like
a dancer.
Like a dancer.
Yes, she does. And she takes incredible risks. I mean, she said in one interview in the New Yorker, she said, She said, my role in life is to dust off old operas, dusty operas, she calls them. And she does that in La Sonnambula, which is the sleepwalker at the Santa Fe Opera. At one point, she's walking on a parapet that's 40 feet above the stage.
Good heavens.
And we see her up there stunning. Her white nightgown is blowing in the night breeze. But on the up to her right, there's a drop-off of 40 feet. And it's in total blackness. She's just walking. She seems to be walking in the middle of the night sky. She seems to do that a lot. In Romeo and Juliet, I was very fortunate, I got to interview her for a Met audience when they were doing Romeo and Juliet, and it had just been a night after a drama. And the third act in Romeo and Juliet are in bed together, and the curtain's down, and they have to fly the bed. When the curtain goes up, you see the bed floating in space with Romeo and Juliet in it. But when the curtain was down and the stage staff started pulling the bed up, it tipped. And it threw her out. So Natalie is rolling out of the edge of the bed, this little thing. But a passing stagehand was running by and caught her.
She was
rescued. But Ramon Vargas, who is the tenor, who is a sort of a bulky, chunky wonder
Nobody
from Mexico.
Him.
No, he's hanging on the edge of the bed. Of the four cables, one had given way, and that was what had happened. So they had a long intermission that day, and Natalie said, I'm fine, let's go back and do it. So they grounded the bed. Bed was then grounded, and when the curtains opened, it was on the stage. So I interviewed her just after that, and I said, what about the bed? And she said, oh, it's nothing, it's no big deal. We'll go back and do it again. So she is singing her first Violetta.
She must have been a great Juliet, being this little slight...
Gorgeous, absolutely gorgeous. And she will be, I think, as Violetta too.
Right.
And as it turns out, I have the Metropolitan Opera had a gala, and she sang just the famous aria from the end of the first act, which I'd love to play a little for you. She hasn't sung the entire role, but she has sung this part of it. What's happened here is at the end of the party, she's been coughing, and Alfredo has stayed by and said, I'm concerned about you, and you know, you're not well. And she says, I'm fine. And then the party ends and everybody goes home, and she sits and she thinks, it's strange, but would it be possible for me, a courtesan, to have a happy life, to be truly in love, to be loved, to be taken care of? Could I take the risk? Would it work? So this is the beginning of that aria where she sings Estrano, it's strange. Let's hear Natalie Dessay sing part of this from the end of the first act of La Traviata.
Risolvi o turbo di mio
Hate to come out of that.
I know.
That's really terrible.
Now that is another example, and we've had a few of them in this opera series that we've been doing every Monday, of opera where even if you don't like opera, you might just get a little bit spellbound.
Absolutely. The sound of a voice like that is very hard to resist. I mean, if you're
and
just sitting listening
to
that.
And she's doing it, she'll be here this summer.
She's going to be here this summer. Yes, she comes. They start rehearsals on June 3rd. So.
Do you go to all of them multiple times?
I go to the dress rehearsals because I have to do the preview lectures and know what's going on in the production if I'm to tell other people. So I'll go to at least one or two rehearsals ahead of time and usually at least twice during the run. And if I can get a ticket for more than that, I'll go for that as well.
You know, it's interesting. We were talking while she was singing and we were off the air about what is the equivalent of a courtesan? Kept woman.
Yes, probably today. Yeah.
And there's a bunch of them, I think, in Washington and wherever mm-hmm. there are major league politicians and mm-hmm. and probably other people of that, you know, mafia, other people of that level
right,
of power.
Right. Yeah, fabulous party girls, you know, who are there just to amuse.
But more than that, I mean, it seems like some of them really do provide a kind of not just a sexual but kind of an emotional function in the person's life
yes.
that they're not having
absolutely.
With their wife.
Yep. So it's not gone away. So at the end of the first act then, Violetta has had this moment of truth. Will this work for me? And then she says, no, it's crazy. You know, I can't change my lifestyle. I have to live, love, dance, sing. She also knows that she has this illness that she will probably be not long for this life. And the first act ends on that note. But then in the intermission, she must have had a change of heart because by the time the curtain goes up on Act Two, we find the two of them ensconced in a little love nest in the country outside of Paris. She's hoping it's going to work. And he is absolutely ecstatic. This young man, the woman he loves, has promised to give up her lifestyle and to be with him forever. And they're completely happy. And you hear his happiness in this aria, Bollenti Spiriti, again sung by Marcello Alvarez from the beginning of the second act of La Traviata.
Il giovani ardore, bella temprosa e placido, sorriso dell'amor, dell'amor. Dai di che vissa vivere, io voglio che fuere. Vivere, io voglio te fedele.
You can hear his happiness there.
Yeah, you Can't argue with that voice either.
No, exactly. It's beautiful, a Verdi tenor. But this is the last happy moment, I suppose, in this opera, because now it turns out that Violetta, somebody has to finance this little love nest in the country, and it's Violetta who is doing it. And when Alfredo finds out from her maid, Annina, that Violetta is selling her jewels and her carriage and her horses in order to maintain their lifestyle in the country, he is so angry, he goes off to Paris to try and raise some funds. But while he is away, there is a gentleman caller who comes to Violetta, and it's Alfredo's father, Germont. He comes in and he's shown into her room, and he insults her right from the start. He said, "I'm the father of Alfredo, the young man whose life you are ruining. How did you bewitch him? Why did you choose my son to ruin?" And her response is wonderful. She stands and she says that she must withdraw, more for your sake than mine. There's not to be this embarrassment. And he's a little taken back by it. And this is the beginning of an amazing duet, something that was very new in opera this time, too. It's a real psychological manipulation of Violetta by Germont, the righteous father who is going to separate his son from this evil woman, the courtesan. It's a very telling duet, and the way Verdi writes this is very insightful. So he starts out by telling her that this affair must end because he has a daughter, and the daughter's engaged. But the engagement will be broken off if Alfredo continues his affair with the courtesan. And she begins, she has no intention of giving Alfredo up, and she says, "Well, for a little time, until the wedding is over, perhaps I will agree to separate. And he says, "No, I must ask more of you than that." And then the mood changes imperceptibly in different directions here as the psychological game plan goes forward. Finally, Germont turns to her and he says, "Well, you know, you can never be married. You cannot have children, you cannot lead a normal life with my son. Society won't allow that." And he said, "Then Alfredo, you will get older, you will lose your beauty, and Alfredo will stray." Now, this is an argument she understands. And she begins, the orchestra will tell, there's a tremolo strings that begin to describe her fear, that she begins to realize that it is going to have to end. And he pushes then. He says, I know you will have, there will be plenty of other lovers. And she says, "No, there will be no one else," because she knows that she has consumption, but he doesn't. But finally, she really is sacrificed to this social moral code. And she agrees to leave Alfredo, but she doesn't tell Germont exactly how she's going to do this. He's not to know, but she says, "I will leave Alfredo." So let's hear a little of the beginning of this duet, where Germont comes in and they have this discussion, and he sings a lovely aria, actually, about the angel that is my daughter, whose life will be ruined if you continue seeing my son. And here we have Patricia Rosette singing Violetta. Vladimir Chernov sings Germont. And it'll be interesting, here in Santa Fe, we have Natalie Say, as we said, singing the Violetta, and her husband, Laurent Nauri, who's a wonderful baritone, will be singing Germont.
Oh!
It's an interesting familial thing going on. He'll be her father-in-law, or would have been. He is doubling that role with Anthony Michaels Moore, both great baritones. And this is really the turning point of the opera, where he, the father, manipulates her to give up the one true love of her life. So let's hear a little of that duet.
Scopro d'ogni vostro avere vorre volete spogliarli, voi li passate, perché l'accusa
Oh! Alfredo e padre la sorte lo venire da male da retoire suoi due figli.
I due figli?
Sì. Una siccome un angelo e una figlia se Alfredo è guerriere il cielo alla famiglia l'ama che ante gioire cui sposa d'ardito
we're running out of time as we
as
always
usual,
do.
We need to do 2-hour shows, Marisha.
Oh,
so anyway,
I don't know.
A complete course.
Or be more disciplined.
Yeah,
but anyway,
well, we're trying.
But we have time for one more piece from La Traviata, and you're going to play
Maria Callas.
Maria
yes,
Callas
I thought.
Recording.
Yes, so I wanted people to have a sense of listening to different violettas. So we've heard Patricia Rosette, Natalie Desay, and now this final piece that we play with Maria Callas and Alfredo Kraus. This is the death scene where she is dying. Alfredo has abandoned her, but he comes back to the deathbed, which actually did not happen in true life. She died alone of consumption. She's 23 years of age, but he comes back, and his father comes back, Germont, and they both kneel by the side of the bed of the courtesan and they beg her forgiveness. So at this point when he comes in Violetta believes that his appearance will give her her life back and they dream of going to Paris and being together just before she tries to rise from the bed and collapses to the floor. So let's hear a little of Maria. You'll hear the difference of Maria Callas singing Violetta from the last act of La Traviata.
Noi lasceremo la vita uniti, trascorreremo te corsi affanni, compenso avrai la tua salute. Rifiorirà sospiro e luce, tu mi sarai tutto il futuro.
That's it. Isn't that sad? It's the end of the opera.
Well, Desiree, as always, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here. Thank you so much. We'll see you at the opera.
Okay, thanks, Marishana.
Desiree Mays is the author of Opera Unveiled and the nightly lecturer at the Preview Buffet at the Santa Fe Opera. They can be found on the web at santafeopera.org, and the box office number is 800-280-4654. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We are podcasting at the website santafe radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.